I'll start off with, I'm curious to know what kind of sandwich you had, because we talked with Mark yesterday and he came out the gate strong saying he had a tuna and cheese panini, which made me throw up in my mouth a little bit. But
well, I'm going to disappoint you because I also had tuna.
No!
But it was tuna and cucumber on brown bread, plus a pasta salad and some other salad bits and pieces. So yeah.
Okay, that's not as bad.
Not horrendous.
Welcome to the Commerce Collective podcast by Flywheel. I'm your host, Emma Irwin, senior editor and specialist, and today we are continuing on our European tour to discuss omnichannel retail across the region and, of course, tying in media strategies across the disparate retailers that exist. We will first get the lay of the omnichannel land, which will set us up to talk about media in such an omni environment, and we'll wrap up with a discussion on the quick commerce channel. With that, let's meet our guest.
James Hanscom. My title is Omnichannel Director in Flywheel.
Beautiful. And I would like to know the last thing you purchased on Amazon.
The last thing I purchased on Amazon was a bike lock. We have a great bike parking facility in the Omnicom office, and I can now park my bike in our basement, locked up beautifully to a bike rack downstairs, so it's nice and safe.
Would someone from the office be stealing it?
Probably not. If you look at my bike, they'd be very sad if they had to steal mine rather than someone else's. But you can never be too safe with these things.
I'd like to start this podcast strong and telling me, like, what is there to enjoy about riding a bike? Because I can't do it.
So someone said to me the other day, because I used to be a motorcyclist and they're a motorcyclist. Once you've ridden a motorbike, why would you want to pedal it yourself? And so I actually had to think about this quite hard because I didn't have a ready answer. And I think there's a couple of things. One is I've always been since going to a Catholic boarding school as an 8-year-old, I've always been into basically giving myself a tough time. I hate myself enough to still get some pleasure out of causing myself some pain, which I put down to a strict Catholic upbringing. But there's more than that. I genuinely love the outdoors and I love being out in the fresh air and actually doing it with a motorbike helmet on, where all you're really concerned about is you'll make the next corner. You don't really get to enjoy the mountains and the hills as much as you do on a bicycle. But actually the thing that clinches it for me is it's a sociable sport. You can potter along, and I potter at my age now, and you can chat to your buddies and you can enjoy this a bit of modest exercise and a bit of competitiveness without going too crazy. And you have a nice chat at the same time. So
Fair enough. That's a pretty good explanation. Granted, where I live now, it's a little bit different, but back where I was living before this, I mean, I could get on my bike and I'd have to ride 30 miles before I ended up anywhere. So there's not really any sociable aspect to it because I would just be riding through trees and there'd be nothing other than trees for miles and miles and miles.
Yeah, well, some people like that. So I'd prefer a little bit of something else, but a bit of solitude sometimes is a good thing.
Fair enough. Okay, I'm going to ask you this question now, and then we'll come back to it at the end. But something that is just on your digital wish list that you won't actually purchase and why, but we'll come back to it at the end if that sounds good.
Sounds good to me.
And now, let's get to the good stuff. Prior to sitting down to record these EU episodes, I was given the note that Europe is set up for omnichannel rather than pure play e-commerce such as Amazon. But I wanted to know what that really means and how we see it in action.
In terms of digital commerce media, I mean, Amazon's still the biggest game in town and the biggest EU market. So UK, France, Germany, Spain, Italy. But it's not the only game, certainly not the only game. And particularly when you go to some of the other EMEA markets, if you go to places like Poland, the Netherlands, Turkey, even Sweden, Amazon's really got its work cut out to compete with some of those incumbent local e-commerce sites that the local population have been used to using for years, and which have had a few years as Amazon has grown its footprint across EMEA to really get their kind of retail media house in order. So if you look to Allegro in Poland, which is a kind of Amazon lookalike, all the locals use it. They kind of resent Amazon because it's an interloper, and all the media agencies, all the brands love using Allegro because it's their local product. So in the Netherlands, I've just had a meeting with one of our Dutch colleagues. They spend 10 times as much in bol.com as they do in Amazon. So in some markets, Amazon is the small player. And that's partly because Amazon doesn't do groceries really in Europe very much. It's very, very small. And still in retail media, the suppliers into the grocery industry, so the CPG suppliers, are the ones who still spend the biggest budgets. So really, EU5, wider Europe, there's plenty of scope outside of Amazon for retail media. And actually, one of the things that slightly grates to old lags like me who've been in this game for kind of a quarter of a century or so is that people talk about retail media as if it's this new thing. It used to be called sales promotion or merchandising. It's emerged as a media offering really probably in the last probably 20 years, to be honest. And I think what's interesting is kind of how long it's taken for that model to mature. So I was doing retail media in Tesco.com 20 years ago, and it wasn't wildly different from how it is today. And it is still treated as a kind of hybrid between trade driving and media. And I think, you know, if you look in that intervening time, if you looked at things like search, social media, general programmatic media, they've all come in very quickly, adopted a highly technical approach almost from day one. And it's really taken until now for retail media to come into the 21st century. Now, that was accelerated during COVID quite dramatically when a lot of the kind of traditional bricks and mortar retailers suddenly realized that they could only make a profit by delivering our groceries if they sold a load of advertising. So it's kind of accelerated. But I think it's a really interesting model. And I think one of the reasons it's taken so long to mature is that the traditional retailers that we have who are pitted against Amazon, because they've had it relatively easy in some of the big sectors like grocery from Amazon, is that media's always been tied very intrinsically to the kind of terms agreements between brands and retailers, and almost used as a kind of make weight in that securing digital or shelf space. And sometimes whether or not that advertising has helped drive additional sales has been of kind of secondary importance. It's part of that handshake between brand and retailer. I think what's changed, and I think why I'm really excited about omnichannel retail media in Europe now, is that the change now has been that those businesses are much more professional in the way they trade media. They've seen the opportunity. It's partly because they've seen how Amazon's worked, and they've seen how Amazon's probably taken a larger share of that media pie than they would have liked. But they've opened up self-serve access. They've opened up access to data, which is something that they wouldn't do a few years ago. They're still yet to open up things like access to content management like we can do in Amazon. But if you look at some of the data offerings coming out of the retailers, some of the off-site media offerings coming out of the retailers, it's suddenly become a really exciting place to be. And I think potential that it's always had is really becoming much more real now as a lot of these retailers realize they're sitting on audiences that are actually bigger and probably in many ways more interesting than Amazon audiences. You can tell an awful lot from someone by, you know, we had a chat about your love of tuna. You can tell a lot about people from the type of groceries they buy and how often they buy them and what size packaging they're buying and are they buying children's meals. You know, that tells you a lot about someone that's probably less confusing and they're doing it on a weekly basis than the kind of random stuff that I buy on Amazon. So I think the potential's always been there, but it's really only now in Europe, certainly, that evolution is really sort of hotting up to become more of a revolution.
I am curious, the sense of urgency that we see brands having when it comes to looking at like new places to be investing. Over here in the US, I think sometimes our large enterprise clients, like some of them really want to go all into all the different new opportunities that exist and test it out. And then other ones are like, we very much want to just stick with what we know works. What are you kind of seeing over on your side of the pond in that regard?
Everyone likes something new and shiny, don't they? That's half the difficulty with this stuff. And I think if you look at the way budgets are allocated and spent, I think the vast majority are still allocated based on where the sales are coming from today. So if I'm Kimberly Clark and my biggest retailer in the UK is Tesco, which it probably is, then I probably spend more on retail media in Tesco than I do anywhere else. Now, that's probably right to a point. I guess the thing that they're missing maybe, and I'm not having a go at Kimberly Clark here, I'm just using them as a name. But if you're doing that, then what you're probably missing is that there are some retailers where, for whatever reason, historical, maybe your national account manager wasn't as strong, maybe you're geographically, you're not aligned with them, whatever it is, you may be underperforming in that retailer. And to me, there's always there's an element of this, which should be, where's my potential? Where's there a customer base? Where is there the ability to upsell, to cross-sell, to sell more products in, where I have a higher potential that I could help realize by giving it a bit of a boost with media? And that's kind of what a lot of the budgeting misses, is that element of potential. And that's difficult because retailers aren't about giving out market share information to brands on, hey, you're number three in the category, you could be number one. You know, what they're there, they all want them to spend as much as they possibly can. Or they certainly wouldn't say, look, hey, you're number one in the category, you can back off the media spend now, that's fine, you're doing okay. But obviously, once you get to a certain point, there's probably a limit to, you'll never be the only brand. So at what point does that level off? And I think that's probably a challenge of planning these things that I don't think anyone's really cracked yet, but maybe there's a measurement which shows a diminishing law of returns where you eventually see that you've probably got as far as you're going to get and you shift gear and go to another retailer and see where you can, how far you can push that.
Interesting. I was going to ask for the question of like looking at where is the potential, you know, how would you determine where the potential is and kind of advise that back to a brand asking you, where is the potential? So there's got to be a brand here and there that's asking you this question.
Yeah. And you think about how we do this in Amazon. We've got a pretty good, if someone's using our market share technology, they know exactly at a brand level or at a category level where they are in terms of their share. And we have a lot of campaigns where client says, hey, I want to be number one in this category. How much do I need to spend to get there in media? And we're pretty good at that. We don't have that same level of information about omnichannel retail. Now, there's ways of doing it. So we can look at it probably not necessarily on a day-by-day, week-by-week basis, but an electronics retailer will subscribe to GfK and they'll be able to see at a fairly granular level what their share is. And they'll be able to see it moving over time. So we can see that. And we can use, you know, some of the resources they tap into to start measuring our media in different ways. So, you know, I'm all about counting impressions and clicks and ROAS as much as the next man. But what I really want to know is, am I really making a material difference with what I'm doing to how much product I sell and how much market share I'm grabbing in a fairly tight competitive market? So is my advertising money being well spent effectively? Or am I just literally paying for stuff I probably would have got anyway, which I'm guessing quite a lot of people are doing in this market.
Now that we've talked about the overall omnichannel landscape and have hit on some elements of retail media across all of the different players in the region, I started to think about the types of challenges that omnichannel retailers and then even brands face. Thinking about profitability, advertising efficiency, inventory, and beyond. So I asked James about challenges in this realm, especially looking at the grocery sector.
It's actually a really good question, and it's one of the thorniest problems particularly with grocery e-commerce, is that a lot of the you accidentally stumbled upon a really important point here, maybe. Your unerring instinct for an interesting fact. So if you look at a lot of the e-commerce models in Europe, they've emerged from bricks and mortar retailers who realize that their customers want to buy online as well as in store. And they've kind of reluctantly been dragged into that because it costs them more. For years, they trained us to get in our cars, drive to our local supermarket, go and select all our own products, go and queue up dutifully and pay for them, incidentally, almost in cash, and they didn't pay their suppliers for 30 days. So it was all sorts of ways of making quite good money. And suddenly, I'm sitting at home and I'm getting on the internet and saying, right, you do that for me now. And they send someone around the local store with a trolley, and you see in there sort of picking their products, and you don't always get the best vegetables, but, you know, yogurt's on their sell by date potentially is a, you know, those sorts of problems. But basically they're having to do a load of the work that I would have done for them, and I'm still paying the same amount of money for those products. So they have to sell advertising to pay for that. But the other thing that people don't really think about that much is that the product range that you have in store, whilst in some of these stores is massive, actually is not endless. And if all I'm offering is, if they're picking from my local store in Streatham, which is my neighborhood in South London, then the only products I can select from when I go online are the ones they have in store in Streatham. Or I could go to the posh one in Dulwich and get some other quinoa or something like that, which is not available in Streatham. From an advertising point of view, for the retailer, if you're an online retailer like Amazon, your shelf is endless. Yeah, you can have several thousand products in the same category. If I want to get my product to be considered, I have to be in the top page or two, or no one's going to reach it. In that grocery world where you've got a limited set of products, if I search for toothpaste, I only get two pages of toothpaste. I actually get probably like 10. But if the main three brands will all be on that first page. So is there really that stiff competition for being in that top slot that you get on Amazon? Does that really encourage a really dense auction that pushes up the price of a cost per click, so the retailer makes tons of money. Not so much. I mean, it's a bit more limited. So it's just something that probably people don't really realize that much, but it's not always clear cut that you have to spend money on media in order to be in that first page. You get your content right, you do some nice SEO in your product detail pages, you might get on that first page without having to pay for it. So why would you?
Interesting. That has me thinking about, so Walmart over here, granted a Walmart store has about a bazillion SKUs in it anyways, but every brand can't offer their full catalog. And one of Walmart's biggest pushes this year and a little bit last year is to, like, for these brands where they don't have in-store agreements, put their additional catalog out on Walmart Marketplace. And so I'm kind of curious, when we're talking, I know we were just talking groceries specifically, but, like, do you think that you're going to see more and more retailers over in Europe taking that approach where they build out this kind of more distribution and ability to build up a digital marketplace for all those products that don't fit in the store that then increases the auction and makes them more money?
Maybe. I mean, if you think about, if I take a retailer like a consumer electronics retailer, a MediaMarkt or a Currys, those products don't have a sell-by date, so it's actually much easier to store them. But if you've got inventory that's sitting in a warehouse somewhere waiting for someone to buy it, that's dead money. So no one really wants to do that, to be ready for everything anytime, anywhere. So it's always a distribution challenge. And actually, if you think about the way the effect that e-commerce is having on brands, it is making them become distribution companies as much as brand sellers. They have to have product going all over the place in the right numbers at the right time in order to be able to fulfill all sorts of channels. And I think probably where the developments will take place is a lot of brands, FMCG brands will never go direct to consumer other than there's vanity projects or, you know, as a sort of, whether it's a expensive razor that you then get bought by P&G or whatever it is, you know, it's a kind of one-off. But a consumer electronics brand or someone who's got high-value products, actually it starts to make sense for them to drive some of their business to direct-to-consumer sites. And it's, I think it's really interesting when you look at what Amazon is doing in things like its offsite offering, its DSP offering, Prime Video. They're thinking themselves as much as a media owner, probably more as a media owner than a retailer. I joked recently that, and it was only half a joke, that Amazon, the only reason Amazon still sells stuff on the website is so they can measure the effect of their advertising. And there's an element of truth in that. Now, I think what's going to be really interesting over the next couple of years is that a lot of the retailers around Europe, so Carrefour in France, Tesco in the UK, are seeing they're sitting on these audiences, which are, as I said earlier on, very rich first-party audiences. We're seeing cookies being maybe finally deprecated by Google. So a lot of the traditional media, digital media that people are buying is out the window. Suddenly you've got these big businesses with retail operations sitting on decent-sized audiences, first-party audiences, and a reasonably sophisticated media offering. There's potential there. And it'd be really interesting to see how they progress and how they grow over the next couple of years.
The last segment of conversation we had for this episode was to cover quick commerce because of its prominence and growth in Europe. I asked James to tell me about the media landscape when it comes to quick commerce, if the media landscape is sophisticated enough or even worthy enough of talking about.
I'm torn on this one. You only have to go to, I don't know if you've been to the UK recently, but McDonald's used to be a fast food restaurant. If you go to McDonald's now in London, it takes you about 45 minutes to get served because there will be at least 100 Deliveroo drivers all waiting for McDonald's deliveries to be ready and collected. So McDonald's has almost sort of destroyed itself as a fast food operator. But you can see all these people ordering McDonald's through Deliveroo and not paying a great deal of money for it. No, I think that's partly a generational thing. I can guarantee you I would never order a McDonald's online. It feels wrong on every level to me. I mean, although I'm not being snobbish, I love a Big Mac, don't get me wrong. But just when I come home on a Sunday afternoon, having been out for a bike ride, my son and his girlfriend are there and they've got whatever local takeaway they've just had delivered by Deliveroo. Everything they think of is, well, it's an instant gratification. They'll get Deliveroo. So that model of having a guy waiting around on a bike for someone to call and say, I want a McDonald's or I want some groceries, some snacks from the local corner shop. I mean, it's, you know, all these sort of things are now possible, more so in London than probably in the provinces or whatever, but certainly in London, and certainly a generational thing. How do they pay for that stuff? they better be bloody good at selling advertising on their app, because there's no other way of making that profitable. They've tried circumventing the minimum wage, having gig economy workers delivering on motorbikes. It's just a really expensive model to run, so you've got to fund it with advertising. I think we've seen a fair bit of shakeout already in the delivery market. You know, there was a sort of sudden growth in people needing stuff delivered because they wouldn't venture out of their homes. There's been, since then, there's been a fair amount of consolidation, but I think you will get some winners. And I do think those winners will be those who convert their audiences into a profitable asset, much the same way that someone like Instacart has in the US, not necessarily by being a retailer or selling product, but by being a really, really good middleman and having a really effective and easy to buy into media offering that funds it. So I think there will be some winners. I mean, I suspect Deliveroo will be one of those winners. I'd also be fascinated to see, so in a classic sort of defensive move, some of the retailers have launched their own, you know, instant gratification home deliveries, limited range, you know, half hour, 1 hour delivery slots and so on. Tesco have got Whoosh, Ocado have got Zoom, you know, the clue's in the name, it's sort of, it's there, you know. I'm guessing those guys are tanking in terms of revenue at the moment, but it's a defensive mechanism. If it's, those things survive, it'll be because they have certain advertisers who really want to capture that market, to become either they use that to gain market share, or they use it because their products are the sort of products you buy when you're hungover or when you're hungry or whatever. You know, they're sort of instant gratification sort of products. And if they make it work and they keep it, it'll be because they've managed to fund it effectively through attracting a different set of advertising from a different set of brands. But I think the jury's out for me whether that's going to be long-term profitable. But then I guess my generation is probably on its way out, and that generation who look for the instant gratification of, I want it now, I'm not waiting, I want it in 10 minutes, I can't be bothered to move off the sofa, that might be the generation that makes this stuff work.
Ouch. I usually like to get in, granted, I get in my car and we'll drive the 5 minutes down the road, because if I walk, I'll get hit by a deer or something like that. But fair enough, fair enough. Narrating Emma here before we wrap up with the digital wish list. Quick clarification on my last point there, because the full thought did not actually make it out of my mouth during the recording. That happens often. If I get hit by a deer, what I meant was that I will get in my car to go to the store 5 minutes away, which I know baffles Europeans, but without my car, I have to cross a major highway with these big barriers on foot that many deer unsuccessfully try to cross, hence why I might get in my car to go to the store, because if not, I will probably get hit with another car or a deer. Point of all of that was that I might be Gen Z, but at least I'm Gen Z that will get in its car to get off the couch. Case closed. On to James's digital wish list.
Everlasting life. No, I. So I talked about my love of cycling and the fact that I bought a bike lock. I've entered this insane event in September, which is clearly going to be way too hard for me. I'm just too old, too unfit, too fat, whatever. It's an 8-day. Well, 8-day is the cutoff. Ultra off-road bike race that starts in Monton on the south coast of France and finishes in Geneva, with something like 23,000 meters of climbing in between off-road. And I'm clearly in no shape to do that, but if there's any gadget that I can find on Amazon or anywhere else that makes me faster, lighter, fitter, younger, I mean, more attractive would be nice, but that probably won't matter so much, but generally bulletproof, then I would definitely buy it. In fact, I will buy lots of things hoping they will deliver that, even if they don't.
At that point, you might just need a rocket. Like, just need.
You've got it. That's what it is. A motorbike. Why didn't I think of that?
That's like the Iditarod for biking. I think the Iditarod usually lasts 8 days. Is that a thing that people outside of the US know of?
Never heard of it.
Dog sled race where they go through Alaska for like 100, or maybe it's even hundreds of miles. But interesting. All right. That was such an odd tangent for me to go on. I think that's everything.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
On the topic of dog sledding, if you ever want to learn more and or cry for multiple reasons, you should watch 8 Below. That was happy. Anyways, with that, we have made it to the end of another episode of the Commerce Collective podcast and have now given Europe a slightly comprehensive spotlight on the show. Please do share this with anyone you think would find it interesting and or informative. And I haven't said this one in a long time, but hey, we would still love your feedback via ratings and reviews wherever you are listening. As always, if you're interested in learning more about Flywheel, I'm your girl, Emma Irwin, and we'll see you next time. Mush!